House Committee on Revenue for June 12, 2017 will come to order. Thank you, colleagues, for being here on time, and I apologize for being a little slow figuring out exactly what we are ready to do today. The House Bill 2274 it continues to need additional work. We're working on additional amendments at the behest of those who want additional clarity. So we'll post that again for tomorrow. House Bill 3459 is ready to work today, we think. House Bill 2064 it needs some additional work, and it's not ready. We're working on some of the details in that bill. House Bill 3443 is also not ready today. Again, additional details need to be worked. We hope to work House Bill 3359, and we don't have paperwork for, but we want to have a conversation about 3435 and 2377. So we have plenty of work to do, and recognize that the House reconvenes at, I think, 2:30, if I remember right. So we have to be out of here before then. So let's open the work session on House Bill 3459. I'll just go down the list. 3459. Kyle, you want to tell us where we are on that bill?
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3459, we do have the -2 amendment. And as a reminder, the bill is making changes to property tax exemption that's available under ORS 307-130, and it's specific to retail stores, and allowing the retail stores that are, the requirements, I should say, are more or less retail store has to do with supporting animal services or supporting animals in some way. These are going to be domesticated animals, pets really. But so the requirement in 3459 and the changes made are in the structure of the retail store. So the first change is the employees, if you will, of the retail store. It should be primarily, or not primarily, but it would be operated with substantial support from volunteers, and then it requires all the net proceeds of the retail store to be donated as specified. And so the specifications for the donations are in the background of the SMS, the four bullet points. If we scroll down there, you can see how the funds have to be expended, and it'd be for the nonprofit corporation, have to be expended to support a nonprofit corporation that provides animal rescue services. Could also go to a manufacturer or a provider of goods or services if it's in return for an equivalent value of the goods or services. So in that way, it'd really be structured as allowing the thrift store, the nonprofit thrift store, to purchase goods from a manufacturer. Can also go to an entity that provides spaying or neutering services for pets of individuals residing in households with annual household income at or below 80% of area median income. And then also for the purpose of aiding domesticated animals in furtherance of the purpose for which the nonprofit corporation was organized. So there's just some of the changes to the underlying bill with the -2 amendment. We have the fiscal paperwork. It is a minimal. The revenue impact with the changes in the -2, we upgraded a little bit from a minimal to it's about $100,000 or so expected per biennium in a property tax reduction.
I would note that when we heard this bill, we asked Representative Gomberg to put sideboards on it. It looks like he's done that in the -2. Colleagues, what's your pleasure? Representative Smith Warner?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendment to House Bill 3459.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves the -2 amendment to House Bill 3459. Discussion? Objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Smith Warner.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3459 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves House Bill 3459 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Representative Gomberg will carry, and with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3459 and open a work session on House Bill 3357. Representative Kenny Geyer, did you want to be heard on this one?
I'm just here to answer any questions.
Thank
and show
you.
Support.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3357 has the A3 amendment along with a number of alternate amendments in AULIS, but the paperwork is done on the A3, and it is simply a fiscal and revenue light statement in order to pass it through to Ways and Means. The measure would increase the document recording fees by double that go to various home ownership accounts, including the general housing account, the home ownership assistance account, and the emergency housing account, and specifies they'd be used to provide affordable housing. And the A3 provides for an exemption from the fee for the county tax collectors. Previously, they had been paying that fee typically two times, once to file a warrant and the second to file for the release of the warrant. And the this piece brings in the revenue impact is $14 million during the 2016 fiscal year in total, and approximately $350,000 of this is due to the tax collectors paying these fees. And so with that exemption from that for the tax collectors, the $14 million would be reduced by the $350,000 for the revenue impact to be reduced by that much. But the measure would just has a light revenue light statement and a fiscal light statement for passage to Ways and Means.
All right. Colleagues, if you'll recall, the A3 amendment is the one that the assessors and tax collectors were asking for, because under the current law, they actually have to pay this fee, when they are doing routine tax collection work. And as I understand the A3 amendment, this would excuse them from paying that fee. Is that right? Right. All right. Are we ready to move this bill, Representative Buehler?
Yeah.
Did you have something?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Yeah, I've been a big supporter of the document recording fee, but there's been some problems with this fee over the years, which when I was on the House Housing Committee came to light, and both Representative Wisdent and I brought bill in the 2015 session because this fee was being accumulated for a long period of time in the agency and not getting out the door. So it came to light that there was, I believe, $30 to $40 million that accumulated that hadn't been allocated for this very important problem of trying to increase the supply of affordable housing. In addition, we found out that it was not being distributed around the state in a very geographically equitable fashion, meaning some counties got quite a bit of these dollars and others counties did not. Now, having said that, I do think the agency has done a much better job under new leadership in getting the dollars out the door and also trying to spread it around the state. But I do think we should make sure that this can't happen again in the future, and that's why I've submitted A6 and A7 amendments. The A7 amendment also has a request for a study to see how our current land use planning policies and procedures have affected the availability of affordable housing, what's driving up the cost of affordable housing. There's been quite a bit of media attention on the high cost per square foot of building affordable housing in Oregon, and also the effect that it's having on segregation by race and the effects our land use planning process has had on gentrification, particularly in the Portland metro area. So that's both the A6 and A7 amendments have those concepts embedded in them.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner, the A3.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A3 amendment to House Bill 3357.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner moves the A3 amendment to House Bill 3357. Is there any discussion about that amendment? Representative Johnson.
Oh, yeah, no.
you think they should be paying the fee?
I would support the dash 6 or dash 7 instead.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive, are they?
I think it'd be okay. I think they're okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Better call the roll. The question is on the adoption of the dash 3 amendment.
Representative Bueller.
Yes.
Representative Fernandez.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Marsh.
Aye.
Representative Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith Warner.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. Motion carries. And the dash 3 amendment will be added to the bill. Representative Smith Warner.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3357 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Oh, sorry. With a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Right. Thank you.
I still said that.
Yes, it does have to go to Ways and Means. Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves House Bill 3357 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Further discussion? Representative Johnson.
I'll be a no on the bill, Mr. Chair. I just feel it's a tax. It's a document recording tax increase, and I don't think it's going to help our affordable housing situation in the state, and I do think there are other ways to accomplish what's in view here, but I can't support the base bill.
Thank you. The question is on the bill going to Ways and Means. Please call the roll.
Representative Bueller.
No.
Representative Fernandez.
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Smith, Vice Chair Smith Warner?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. Motion carries. The bill goes to Ways and Means. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3357. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 3435. And, is that yours?
No.
Oh, it's Mazin's. Mazin, do you want to give us the brief, and then we'll hear from Representative Brock Smith.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is the bill that we've heard once before. This was the idea of allowing counties to loan some taxing districts amounts that are in the road fund and charging them for the interest in the same way the state treasurer does. I think we have an amendment to look into this in a little narrower way of doing this.
Thank you. Representative, thank you for coming today. Why don't you tell us about your A4 amendment and why you think that's helpful for the bill?
Appreciate it, Chair Barnhart. Committee, thank you very much for working the bill today. The dash 4 amendments.
For the record.
For the record, State Representative David Brock Smith, House District 1, Southwest Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you. The dash 4 amendments are a work effort that I had after the hearing to really finalize the sideboards that are necessary in this bill. I worked with the state treasurer's office on these dash fours. And it does look like a gut and stuff, technically, but the dash fours basically incorporate the original bill and the changes. As you can see as we go through, in hindsight, I didn't realize that counties wouldn't want this opportunity because of the, of course, line that they would receive at the door, libraries wanting to be able to loan or borrow money and so on and so forth. So hence the reason the bill is narrowed to three counties in your under Section 1. And then the ability to use those dollars into taxing districts, not just within your own county, but other counties, so that we can open those possibilities up for folks. Klamath County, for example, has over $80 million in their road fund. They're not generating a lot of revenue, and they would like to assist other taxing districts within the state to be able to move forward projects, and therefore there's other sideboards in the bill that says, if you look at the sub A under section 2, the loan amount can exceed the lesser of the estimated taxes collected by the taxing districts, and so therefore that is the first collateral that is going to be offered up, is the special districts revenues that they receive in taxing districts in their tax revenues. And then I don't know that, Mr. Chair, if you want us to go through the whole bill.
I think it would be useful, since the concern about the bill before had to do with the sideboards.
Yes.
And I think most of the bill is sideboards. So
it is sideboards.
Why don't you describe them for us?
So the sub A, of course, is the plus interest in the loans can't exceed 20 years. Now, this does not limit, of course, the bill to a or the loan to a, you know, a mandatory 20-year loan. It could be that, again, Klamath County could loan their school district $2 million to repair the roof that the school district has already been saving for, and so therefore they would be able to do this. Now, when you move into the subsection B, it talks about the annual debt service amounts and how they need to be estimated to be realistic, and then also how it solidifies that the obligation of the borrower in the tax district or the county that the monies are loaned. Then subsection 3, the monies loaned under this section have to be a legally binding intergovernmental agreement with the loan, so that the borrower in the taxing district can agree that the county is setting up this ability to assure that that school district is obligating their tax dollars to pay back the loan if there's ever a default. And then, again, these are a lot of the amendments that we dealt with the Treasury Department to make sure that. And then, finally, on the second page, you have to fix the principal amount of the loan. And this is where we needed to make sure that the loan was fixed with the principal and interest, and it won't and it has to be equal to or more than what is currently generated in the local government investment pool, and so we really look at this bill as the ability for special districts to work together to help themselves, and this could really assist in not needing to go out for bonding as often as possible if these revenues could be utilized. And then lastly, the last sideboards are pretty straightforward with regards to the borrowing and the taxing districts. If they're unable to meet the debt, it's now in the bill how the bodies in the borrowing of the taxing districts or county and the lender shall account for the loan and repayment of thereof. Again, it's a good bill. It would assist not just the counties that are named, but because the sideboards have been broadened to allow those counties to loan dollars to other taxing districts and counties within the state. The commissioners, of course, will have to negotiate with the other taxing districts, but the sideboards, I believe, are in place now, and I appreciate the push from the chair to make sure that they were, this is something that we really can help ourselves.
Thank you. And you worked with Laura Lockwood McCall on these amendments. She's been a very, very useful expert to this committee in the past on exactly this kind of issue, so yeah. That's why I sent you to her. We don't have the paperwork on this bill, do we? So are there any questions for Representative Smith? Rep. Brocksmith? Yes. Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative, for being here. So I understand fully the concept of lending the money out from the road fund and the fact that it's sitting there and accumulated. But I'm feeling queasy about the idea that the money could be loaned outside the county. These are counties where we know there's tremendous needs. We're being asked in other venues for tax exemptions and support for efforts within those counties. So I don't know why we would allow money that's accumulated in a fund to travel outside the counties that we know are in greatest need.
So thank you, Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, for the question. You have Curry is probably the county that's there that's in tremendous need. And the reason why the bill is allowed to loan those dollars outside of the county is because, unfortunately, there's a systemic breakdown of the, not just the county services, but the services in general across the county. And so the other purpose behind this bill is to generate more interest to grow the road fund by utilizing these ability to loan it to the various taxing districts. Because currently the LGIP, where these dollars are located, fluctuates between 1 and 0.5%. And so if it can be loaned to refinance debt and or help build a hospital or help with our school systems where they have a taxing district and board of directors that are saving dollars, but we can expedite the process. I guess what I'm trying to say, Representative Marsh, is Curry County doesn't really have the taxing districts because of the systemic problems with regards to revenue to be able to enter into a loan, whereas they have $30 million in the road fund, and so they have the ability to invest those dollars to generate more revenue, possibly with Jackson County, or possibly with Multnomah County, or possibly with Clackamas County, or possibly the school district in Clackamas County that has the ability to pay those dollars back, whereas the school districts in Curry might not. And so these road funds are restricted. They can't be used except for a bill that allows those dollars to be used to fund the direct and indirect cost of patrol within the county. But they can't be used in other ways to fund the assessment and taxation department or services within the county. And so,
question.
Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Follow up. So the interest that comes back, you loan the money out to some other county, interest comes back, it goes back into the road fund?
Yes, ma'am.
So it's still restricted?
Correct.
So what have you done?
You're growing the amount of road dollars so that you can repair and build roads, take care of bridges. Curry County, for example, has over 3,000 culverts, many of which need to be replaced. By generating more interest in the road fund, you still need to take care of. The problem is the amount of dollars coming into the road fund from the resources from U.S. Forest Service lands have been diminished as well. So ONC lands go to county general funds, Forest Service lands go to road funds, and the amount of dollars are coming in are 25% of what they historically would receive. So we're just trying to do anything we can to hold that nest egg in place, because in the current proposed budget in Curry County, for example, they're spending about $2.5 million of those reserves, including above what is generating for new revenues coming in.
And one final question then.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if there are needs, I'm not sure I understand why there is a substantial reserve in the road fund.
So the, just like with the ONC payments, the historic payments coming into these counties to fund services to citizens were as such that they were in $4-5 million annually. Since the decline in timber harvests, off the federal forest system, again, road funds is U.S. Forest Service lands, those dollars were accumulated over time. The roadmaster was there for over 40 years. He did a wonderful job, Dan Crumley. And he was getting to a point, or trying to get to a point, to where he could set up a fund to where with new existing revenues coming in and the interest alone off of the road dollars would be able to sustain the department and be able to keep that in a an interest-bearing fund. Unfortunately, that's not the case. The county has been taking roughly $1.2 million, $1 million a year over the last few years. They did not take any, I believe they only used $200,000 in road funds for their 17-18 budget. And so with the transportation package that you all have been working on that brings more revenues to the county and their road funds, with the ability through this bill to be able to invest those dollars to get rather than a 0.44% interest, but a 2.5% or 3.5% or 4.5% interest, we can start building those funds again, and which is the other purpose behind the bill. It's not only the purpose to have the ability to generate road dollars, but also the purpose again is to help ourselves. There's a port that needs dollars with regards to the Port of Brookings Harbor. There's a bill that is floating through this building that would generate revenue or give revenue to that port to do so. This bill would be able to, they already have debt with the Infrastructure Finance Authority. With this bill, they pay 5.5-6% interest. They would be able to utilize this piece of legislation to refinance that debt, let's say to 3% interest, therefore save two and be able to utilize those dollars at 2% interest at $2.5 million would generate another employee and or dollars to assist with their infrastructure repair and maintenance of their port.
Thank you. Other questions on this bill? So we're not ready to work it today. Please think about it and consider it, and we'll be rescheduling when we have the paperwork. All right. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3435.
Thank you, Chair.
And open the work session on House Bill 2377. That's Kyle's. You stay there. Okay.
And I have Mark from DOR here as well because he was the...
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2377, we have the dash A4 amendment. And just as a reminder, the underlying bill was creating a property tax exemption for multi-unit rental properties that are rented to affordable housing or rented at rates really at 80% to residents that could afford the rent that are 80% or below of area median income. The dash 4 amendment is making three changes to the engrossed version of the bill. The first one is it's limiting the exemption eligibility for the property that has been rehabilitated to the first instance of rehabilitation. So again, this is newly built or rehabilitated property. So instead of being rehabilitated two or three times, it would just be the first time where you'd actually get the property tax exemption, or the first time since the property tax exemption is created. The second change is requiring the property to be rented to households with an annual income at or below 80% of area median income. So in the A and gross version, it was rented at a rate affordable to, but this would actually require it be rented to those households that are 80% or below. And then it also requires the definition of the area median income to be adjusted for the size of the household. So the greater the size of the household, that area median income would adjust reflective of that. So those are the three changes in the bill with the A4.
Okay.
Chair Barnhart, committee, and thank you, Kyle, for that. He answered all the questions that we already had. DOR had some, if you remember.
For the record.
Thank you. David Brocksmith, State Representative, House District 1. I just want to point out that four members of your committee are either chief sponsors or sponsors of this bill. And so.
This help.
But as we all know, we have an affordable housing issue in the state of Oregon, and it's not just in Portland. It's in Curry County. It's in Coos County. it's along the coast. You have 30% of the properties that are owned in Curry County are owned by people that don't live there. When this bill came up before, Representative Johnson had mentioned rehabilitated homes, or excuse me, rehabilitated multifamily dwellings. We added that to this bill because there are a lot of rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of rehabilitation that is occurring right now.
Right.
We also wanted to make sure, and I appreciate, of course, Mark's concerns and his work with me on this legislation. I appreciate Representative Marsh's work with me on this legislation. There, many months ago, Pam and I are here a little later, and so I would always come over down the hall to her office and say, so what do you think about this? And she was very helpful in crafting a lot of the language that is now in the dashboards. But this bill is just one of the many tools in the toolbox to assist with affordable housing, more towards the workforce side rather than low-income side. This is geared to folks that will, I know in my district, I'm sure in Representative Johnson district, in Coos County where and Curry, we're having an issues with regards to our teachers are retiring, but we don't have any housing for our teachers that are coming in. And the housing that's there, they just can't afford. The same thing with our nurses and nurse practitioners are having some serious issues, I know, in Bandon right now with regards to housing. And I've had conversations with their CEO. So these sideboards that we were able to work out and definitions that we've worked with DOR on, I think, have the bill ready to move out of your committee. Mark?
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division, and we appreciate Representative Brock Smith working with us to clarify a few things that we thought were a little open-ended in the original bill. Kyle hit on three of the changes. The only fourth one that I would add is that it also has the city or county define what affordable means, and so that'll be up to the local jurisdiction to define. I think the League of Cities testified at the last hearing that typically that's considered to be 30% of gross income, but then we did a little bit more looking, and actually HUD, for instance, defines it as 30% of gross income including utilities, so the rent itself would actually have to be slightly less than 30% in order to qualify mm-hmm. for that definition. Sure. So this will leave the local jurisdiction the flexibility to define what affordable means, and then we think that the other changes clarify the bill significantly and should be administrable.
Great. Questions? And I noticed you were correct. There are four members on the bill from the committee, and it seems to be very much bipartisan. Mm-hmm. Any idea when we might get the paperwork so we can get an estimate of the revenue and fiscal impact?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we just put the request through right when the meeting started. So hopefully we'll try to have it ready for tomorrow.
Okay.
But again, this is a permissive property tax exemption to the city or a county, so the revenue impact, of course, will be dependent upon mm-hmm. How many of the local governments do adopt it.
Right. So run over again. We pass this bill and we give this authority to the local governments. What is their flexibility? What are they able to modify in order to make it fit their local conditions?
Do you want me to take that?
Please.
Sure. So, Chair Barnhart, so it has them do a few different things. First of all, they set up the what's called a schedule for how many years the property tax exemption will run, and that's up to 10 years. And it increases directly with the percentage of units that are rented to households that fall within that kind of more moderate income folks. So they set that schedule up. They define what affordable means, as I discussed. They define area median income, and they look to what type of units are going to be out there. So, you know, a studio should have a different rent than a two-bedroom, obviously, to still be affordable. They'll set that kind of criteria. I mean, local control also, I mean, I think you have to talk about the districts, and this requires 51% of the districts to adopt, and then if that happens, then all of the taxing districts are included. So that's another little element of local control there. I think that is most of it. I know those are the big ones.
It really gives the local jurisdictions the ability to cite, and through the mechanisms that Mark had mentioned and we had mentioned earlier, the ability to allow a negotiation when it comes to how many units are going to be in the program and for the length of the term of the abatement. So the developer that is going to be building the multifamily housing can sit down with the planners in the county or the local jurisdiction, county or city, prior to even any shovel moving, and get this ironed out ahead of time so that each jurisdiction knows what to expect. And it's really a universal tool in that aspect, and will help significantly, in our opinion, with driving the building of workforce of affordable housing in Oregon.
Thank you. Other questions? The only one other one I have is we passed a lot of bills in this committee over the last several sessions that to the uninitiated like me, who doesn't really understand the details of all these policies, look an awful lot like this bill. How is this different from what we've already adopted? Why is it needed?
It really...
I know that's a question I ought to ask Representative Kenny Geyer, who chairs the committee that's related to this issue. But you're here, so I'll ask you.
And I will, Chair Barnhart, I will attempt to answer it because I'm not familiar with all of the other pieces of legislation that allow this, but I believe Mark has looked into it a little bit, and so I will let him assist with this question, and maybe I can follow up.
Chair Barnhart, I'm sorry, but I'm not really prepared to speak to that today. We did look back through all the exemptions that are out there for multi-unit housing, and there are a number. We came up with a list of a half dozen, maybe seven. And each of them has different requirements. A lot of them are targeted more towards low income, where this is more targeted towards folks that are more median income or working income. That's a pretty big difference. Some of them require ownership by nonprofits. This does not require ownership by nonprofits, so that's a pretty big difference from a couple of the other ones. Some of them require various things, location near transit stops, that kind of thing. So, each of the ones that are out there, they kind of have their own set of standards, and this one I would say is a little bit could have a little bit more broad applicability, but that is what it is. We have that information put together. If anybody wants to see it, we can shoot you an email. We've got the list of all of them in the tax expenditure report. We have the sheets from the tax expenditure report.
Thank you.
And Chair Barnhart, I know that Aaron Doyle from the League of Oregon Cities, her testimony when this was at a public hearing last time touched on that a little bit as well. This is really, as Mark ended with, doesn't have the restrictions that a lot of the others do with regards to siting near transit stations and so forth that are more geared toward the metro areas. This bill will allow that negotiation and the ability for anywhere in Oregon. It doesn't have to be it could be a 10-unit multifamily dwelling versus, and it could be a 150-unit multifamily dwelling. It really has broad application, and again, it's for workforce versus low income.
Mm-hmm. Are there mechanisms in the bill for establishing which units are subject to this exemption? I'm thinking about the qualifications of the tenant.
Yes.
There's the annual reporting requirement, Chair Barnhart. So I don't think it's required that the same units be affordable, but if you say that I'm going to have you know, 20% of my units be affordable, then there's an annual reporting requirement so that the assessor can kind of keep track and make sure that you're meeting that promise. Okay. So that is in the bill.
And does that mean that if you had 20% affordable that you get a 20% tax break?
The schedule will be set up by the local jurisdiction, so they could say...
So they could give 100% tax break
for 20%.
For 20% of the units if they decided to do that.
That's the incentive from the local jurisdiction to we. That's part of the bill that allows the local jurisdiction the control to drive the building of affordable housing in their area.
Okay. Yes.
And Chair Barnhart, and if they, if the city feels like they've been too stingy or too generous, the bill has the ability for them to go back and change the standards of the program at any time. But obviously, the people who were approved under the old standards are grandfathered in and will continue to receive the exemption that they were promised.
Okay. So once they've made a decision, if they have regrets, they can change it for the next set.
Yes.
Okay. That's an important one. I think all of us have had situations come up in our local areas where a city council made a decision and then had quite a bit of time to repent later. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank the good representative for his work on this, but I think you're accurate in characterizing this as workforce targeted rather than just simply low-income housing, and it's a huge need in my community, my home community of the Gorge and Hood River, where an entry-level home is north of $300,000 now.
Yeah.
And I've told this story before, but on the first day of school this year, we literally had teachers living in vans because they could not access housing that they could afford on a salary that's, you know, entry-level salary of $40,000.
Right.
You know, plus benefits and so forth. So it's that sort of workforce in situ, which is the largest employer in the Gorge now, with all kinds of engineers and so forth, big six-figure salaries are now, they're busing people from Portland daily because they can't find housing in the region. So this is the kind of bill that could really be a help. I'm guessing in the Bend area they'd have a similar situation as well, but some of these areas where the economy is just improving dramatically, home prices are going through the roof, but we need people to be able to live in the community that they're working in. So I think this gives local jurisdictions some great latitude on how they want to structure mm-hmm. that. So appreciate the good work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair.
Let me apply in your area, too.
Yeah. I just wanted to highlight the flexibility in which the community is given to define median income, which is really an issue mm-hmm. And varies dramatically sometimes within our jurisdiction. So I think that's a real strength here. I do have a question about administration. Are we expecting that a community that wants to buy into this program would pass an ordinance that is broad enough to set this into place but still allows them the flexibility to negotiate different kinds of deals as they come along?
Chair Barnhart. Representative Marsh, so we kind of had this conversation a little bit, and our at the Department of Revenue, we really prefer that the standards be in the bill as much as possible up front, mm-hmm. because you wouldn't want one person to get a better deal than another person. So the way that we read this, the local jurisdiction will set the standards, like the one that you mentioned, what affordable means, what that schedule is, and then anybody who comes forward who meets the standards for eligible property, which is, you know, multifamily, new or rehabilitated, that anyone would be able to qualify and get the same terms is the way that we see it. So not so much negotiation like an enterprise zone might have. This is a little bit more.
Okay, follow up?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the kind of, Brock Smith, the kind of negotiation you were talking about, could it be 100% of the whole property? Could it be 100% of some number of units? I mean, those kind of parameters would be set in the ordinance in general, how we're going to deal with this, so that it's not something we reinvent with each project?
Correct. Now, the negotiation, the way that I see it is when the communities around the state are going to take advantage of this piece of legislation when, not just that they see the need, but when there is someone that is going to want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, there will be... that's what I kind of meant about the negotiation. There will be a reason to start the ordinance process and really dig into what is going to work for their community when setting the standards up for that community, because each community is going to set their different standards because it's going to be what works for them. If it's going to be defining what, of course, the area median income is, if it's going to be, you know, there's going to, you put X amount of units into this, to, into the program, then you're going to be able to get, you know, a 7-year abatement versus if you put eight, you know, more, you're going to get an 8-year and so forth. So we, the original, before the DOR conversation with the amendments for sideboards, yes, there was more flexibility with regards to that. But when it, in talking with Mark and the Department of Revenue, you get into a situation where there could be a discriminatory factor mm-hmm. that could occur or allow more opportunities for various people getting a better deal, if you will, that could cause the city or jurisdiction more problems than are necessary. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to the paperwork.
Appreciate it.
Thanks. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2377. Paul, just to make sure that we've got it, we've carried over these two bills, 3455, 2377, and also 2274 and 2064 and... Do you want 3443 also carried over, 3443? We have passed out 3459 and 3357. Have I got that? Okay, all right. Colleagues, back on the floor in 35 minutes. We do have a meeting tomorrow morning, a public hearing with the Joint Committee on Tax Reform, and I think we're dealing with the Dash 1 Amendment. We have the Dash 2 now. We will have it shortly. It will be on, you're going to post the Dash 2 amendment. When it's posted, you'll be expected to know it. There will be a test.
All right.
Representative Johnson.
And at what point will we have public comment on
public
that?
Public hearing will start tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning. Is there a second meeting?
We're planning to meet tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock.
Okay.
We actually have scheduled two meetings for tomorrow,
that's
right?
Getting it.
And
five,
I think it's 5 o'clock, isn't it? 5 o'clock.
Okay.
So we have our work cut out for us tomorrow. But the more you understand that, when do you expect it, Paul? This afternoon? Okay. Would you mind sending the members an email when it's posted so they can go look at it? This is a fairly long piece, and it includes partly the existing tax system with some modifications, as I understand it, plus the new piece extended out into the future a little bit. So it's even a little bit more complex than the Dash 1 amendment. So having at least the outline for tomorrow morning, I think, would be valuable. Anything else? We will meet, obviously, at 1 o'clock as well. We have plenty to do. So see you all a whole bunch tomorrow. With that, the committee's adjourned.